stage and arena for greatness, a field upon which a man may display by his deeds the nobility denied him by his birth. The lady's eyes met mine and held them. I want this boy rooster alive when war comes. I want you to protect him. If your ear detects any hint of danger, the slightest rumor, you must come straight away to me. Will you do this? I promised I would. You care for this boy, Zio. Though he has scourged you, I see the friendship you share. I implore you, in the name of my brother and his blood which flows in this boy rooster's veins, will you watch over him? Will you do this for me? I promised that what I could do, I would. Swear it. I complied by all the gods. It seemed preposterous. How could I stand against the Cryptea or any other force that sought to murder Rooster? Still, somehow, my boy's promise seemed to ease the lady's distress. She studied my face for a long moment. "Tell me, Zio," she said softly, "do you ever... have you ever asked anything just for yourself?" I replied that I did not understand the lady's question. "I command one other thing of you. Will you perform it?" I swore I would. "I order you one day to take an action purely for your own sake and not in service to another. You will know when the time comes. Promise me. Say it aloud." "I promise, lady." She rose then, with the sleeping infant in her arms, and crossed to a cradle between the beds of the other girls, laying the babe down and settling it within the soft covers. This was the signal for me to take my leave. I had risen already, as respect commanded, when the lady stood. "May I ask one question, lady, before I go?" Her eyes glinted teasingly. "Let me guess. Is it about a girl?" "No, lady." Already I regretted my impulse. This question I had was impossible, absurd. No mortal could answer it. The lady had become intrigued, however, and insisted that I continue. "It's for a friend," I told her. "I cannot answer it myself, being too young and knowing too little of the world. Perhaps you, lady, with your wisdom, may be able to. But you must promise not to laugh or take offense." She agreed. "Or repeat this to anyone, including your husband." She promised. I took a breath and plunged in. "This friend, he believes that once, when he was a child, alone at the point of death, he was spoken to by a god." I pulled up, minding keenly for any sign of scorn or indignation. To my relief, the lady displayed none. "This boy, my friend, he wishes to know if such a thing is possible. Would a being of divinity condescend to speak to a boy without city or station, a penniless child who possessed no gift to offer in sacrifice and did not even know the proper words of prayer? Or was my friend hatching phantoms, fabricating empty visions out of his own isolation and despair?" The lady asked which god it was who had spoken to my friend. "The archer god, Apollo Farstriker." I was squirming. Surely the lady will scorn such temerity and presumption. I should never have opened my cheese pipe. But she did not mock my question, nor deem it impious. "You are something of an archer yourself, I understand, and far advanced for your years. They took your bow, didn't they? It was confiscated when you first appeared in Lacedaemon." She declared that fortune must have guided me to her hearth this night, for yes, the goddesses of the earth flew thick and near at hand. She could feel them. Men think with their minds, the lady said, women with their blood, which is tidal and flows at the discretion of the moon. I am no priestess. I can respond only out of a woman's heart, which intuits and discerns truth directly from within. I replied that this was precisely what I wished. Tell your friend this, the lady said. That which he saw was truth. His vision indeed was of the God. Without warning, fierce tears sprung to my eyes. At once emotion overwhelmed me. I buckled and sobbed, mortified at such loss of self-command, and astonished at the power of passion which had sprung seemingly from nowhere to overcome me. I buried my face in my hands and wept like a child. The lady stepped to me and held me gently, patting my shoulder like a mother and uttering kind words of assurance. Within moments I had mastered myself. I apologized for this shameful lapse. The lady would hear none of it. She scolded me, declaring that such passion was holy, inspired by heaven, and must not be repented or apologized for. She stood now by the open doorway, through which the starlight fell and the soft babbling of the courtyard watercourse could be heard. "I would like to have known your mother," the lady Arete said, regarding me with kindness. "Perhaps she and I will meet some day, beyond the river. We will speak of her son, and the unhappy portion the gods have set out before him." She touched me once upon the shoulder in dismissal. "Go now, and tell your friend this. He may come again with his questions if he wishes, but next time he must come in person. I wish to look upon the face of this boy who has sat and chatted with the Son of Heaven." Chapter 14. Alexandros and I received our whippings for Antirion the following evening. His was administered by his father, Olympius, before the peers of that officer's mess. I was lashed without ceremony in the fields by a helot groundsman. Rooster helped me away afterward, alone in the darkness, down to a grove called the Anvil beside the Eurotas to bathe and dress my stripes. This was a spot sacred to Demeter of the fields and segregated by custom to the use of Messenian helots. There had once been a smithy upon the site, hence the name. To my relief, Rooster did not treat me to his customary harangue about the life of a slave, but rather limited his diatribe to the observation that Alexandros had been whipped like a boy and I like a dog. He was kind to me and, more important, possessed expertise in cleansing and dressing that unique species of ruptured laceration which is produced by the impact of the knurled birch upon the naked flesh of the back. First water, and plenty of it, bodily immersion to the neck in the icy current. Rooster supported me from behind, elbows braced beneath my armpits, since the shock of the frigid water upon the opened wheels rarely fails to knock one faint. The cold numbs the flesh swiftly, and a wash of boiled nettles and Nessus wort may be applied and endured. This staunches the flow of blood and promotes the rapid resealing of the flesh. A dressing of wool or linen at this stage would be unendurable, even applied with the gentlest touch, but a friend's bare palm, placed lightly at first, then pressed hard into the quivering flesh and held down, brings a relief whose effects approach ecstasy. Rooster had endured his own share of thrashings, and knew the drill well. Within 5 minutes, I could stand. In 15, my skin could take the soft sphagnum, which Rooster pressed into the blotted mass to suck out the poison and to inject its own subtle anesthetic. "By God, there's not a virgin left," he observed, meaning a space that was still God's flesh and not ruptured and re-ruptured scar tissue. "You won't be humping that hymn singer's shield across this back for a month." He was just launching into another venomous denunciation of my boy master when a rustle came from the bank above us. We both wheeled, ready for anything. It was Alexandros. He stepped into view beneath the plane trees, his cloak furled forward, leaving his own throttled back bare. Rooster and I froze. Alexandros would buy himself a second whipping if he was found here at this hour, and us with him. "Here," he said, skidding down the bank to join us. "I picked the surgeon's locker for this." It was wax of myrrh, 2 fingers worth, wrapped in green rowan leaves. He stepped into the stream beside us. "What have you got there on his back?" he demanded of Rooster, who stepped aside with a look of blank astonishment. Myrrh was what the peers used on wounds of battle when they could get it, which they rarely could. They would beat Alexandros half to death if they knew he'd purloined this precious portion. "Get it on him later when you peel off the moss," Alexandros directed Rooster. "Wash it off good by dawn. If anyone smells it, it'll be all our backs and more." He placed the wrapped leaves in Rooster's hands. "I have to be back before count," Alexandros declared. In an instant he had melted away up the bank. We could hear his footfalls vanishing softly as he sprinted in shadow back toward the boys' stations around the square. "Well, bend me over and root me senseless," Rooster spoke, shaking his head. "That little lark's got bigger globes than I thought." At dawn, when we fell in before sacrifice, Rooster and I were called out from our places by Suicide, Dianeces' Scythian squire. We were white with dread. Someone had peeped on us. There would be hell to pay for sure. "Your little turd nuggets must be floating under a lucky star," was all Suicide said. He conducted us to the rear of the formation. Dianeces stood there, silent, alone in the pre-dawn shadows. We took our stations of deference on his left, his shield side. The pipers sounded, the formation moved off. Dianeces indicated that Rooster and I were to stay put. He held stationary before us. Suicide stood on his right, with the quiver of sawed-off javelins he called darning needles, angled nonchalantly across his back. "I've been examining your record." Dianeces addressed me. His first words, other than the summons 2 nights previous to follow the serving boy to his home, ever spoken directly to me. "The helots tell me you're worthless as a field hand. I've watched you in the sacrificial train. You can't even shave the throat of a goat correctly. And it's clear from your conduct with Alexandros that you'll follow any order, no matter how mindless or absurd." He motioned me to turn so he could examine my back. "It seems the only talent you possess is you're a fast healer." He bent and sniffed my back. "If I didn't know better," he observed, "I'd swear these stripes had been waxed with myrrh." Suicide kicked me around, back to face Dianeces. "You're an unwholesome influence on Alexandros," the peer addressed me. "A boy doesn't need another boy, and certainly not a trouble collector like you. He needs a mature man, someone with the authority to stop him when he gets some reckless stunt into his head, like tracking after the army, so I'm giving him my own man." His nod indicated Suicide. "I'm sacking you," he told me. "You're through." Oh, hell. Back to the shitfields. Dianeces turned next to Rooster. "And you? The son of a Spartiate hero, and you can't even hold a sacrificial cock in your fists without strangling it. You're pathetic. You've got a mouth looser than a Corinthian's asshole, and it broadcasts treason every time it yawns. I'd be doing you a favor to slit your cheese pipe right here and save the Cryptea the trouble." He reminded Rooster of Meriones, the squire of Olympias who had fallen so gallantly last week at Antirion. Neither of us boys had any idea where this was going. "Olympias is past 50. He possesses all the prudence and circumspection he needs. His next squire should balance him with youth. Somebody green and strong and reckless." He regarded Rooster with wry scorn. "God knows what folly has inspired him, but Olympias has picked you. You will take Meriones's place. You will attend Olympias. Report to him at once. You're his first squire now. I could see Rooster blinking. This must be a trick. It's no joke, Dionyces said, and you'd better not make it one. You're treading in the steps of a man better than half the peers in the regiment. Screw it up, and I'll spit you over the flame personally.
I won't, Lord.
Dionyces studied him a long, hard moment. Shut up and get the fuck out of here. Rooster took off after the formation at a run. I confess I was ill with envy. The first squire of a peer, and not just that, but a polemarch and king's tent companion. I hated Rooster for his dumb, blind luck. Or was it? As I blanched, numb with jealousy, a picture of the Lady Arete shot across the eye of my mind. She was behind this. I felt even worse and regretted bitterly that I had confided to her my vision of Apollo Farstriker. "Let me see your back," Dionyces commanded. I turned again. He whistled appreciatively. "By God, if there were an Olympic event in backstriping, you'd be the betting man's favorite." He had me face about and stand at attention before him. He regarded me thoughtfully, his gaze seeming to pierce straight through to my spine. "The qualities of a good battle squire are simple enough. He must be dumb as a mule, numb as a post, and obedient as an imbecile. In these qualifications, Xenes of Asticus, I declare your credentials impeccable." Suicide was chuckling darkly. He tugged something from behind the quiver at his back. "Go ahead, take a look," Dionyces ordered. I raised my eyes. In the Scythian's hand stood a bow. My bow. Dionyces commanded me to take it. "You're not strong enough yet to be my first squire, but if you can manage to keep your head out of your ass, you might make a half-respectable second." Into my palm, Suicide placed the bow, the big Thessalian cavalry weapon that had been confiscated from me at 12, when first I crossed the frontier into Lacedaemon. I could not stop my hands from trembling. I felt the warm ash of the bow and the living current that coursed its length and up into my palms. "You'll pack my rations, bedding, and medical kit," Dionyces instructed me. "You'll cook for the other squires and hunt for my pot on exercises in Lacedaemon and beyond the border on campaign. Do you accept this?"
"I do, Lord."
"At home you may hunt hares and keep them for yourself, but don't flaunt your good fortune."
"I won't, Lord."
He regarded me with that look of wry amusement I had observed on his face before, at a distance, and which I would come to see many times more close up. "Who knows?" my new master said. "With luck, you might even get in a pot shot at the enemy." Book 4 Arete Chapter 15 The army of Lacedaemon marched out in 21 different campaigns over the next 5 years, all in actions against other Hellenes. That pitch of enmity which Leonidas had sought since Antirion to maintain focused upon the Persian now found itself of necessity directed against more immediate targets, those cities of Greece which tilted perfidiously toward playing the traitor, allying themselves in advance with the invader to save their own skins. Mighty Thebes, whose exiled aristocrats conspired ceaselessly with the Persian court, seeking to reclaim preeminence in their country by selling it out to the foe. Jealous Argos, Sparta's most bitter and proximate rival, whose nobles treated openly with the agents of the empire. Macedonia, under Alexander, had long since offered tokens of submission. Athens, too, had exiled aristocrats reclining within the Persian pavilions while they plotted for their own restoration as lords beneath the Persian pennant. Sparta herself stood not immune from treason, for her deposed king, Demaratus, as well had taken up the exiled station among the sycophants surrounding his majesty. What else could Demaratus's desire be save reaccession to power in Lacedaemon as satrap and magistrate of the Lord of the East? In the third year after Antirion, Darius of Persia died. When news of this reached Greece, hope rekindled in the free cities. Perhaps now the Persian would abort his mobilization. With her king dead, would not the army of the empire disband? Would not the Persian vow to conquer Hellas be set aside? Then you, your majesty, acceded to the throne. The army of the foe did not disband. Her fleet did not disperse. Instead, the empire's mobilization redoubled. The zeal of a prince freshly crowned burned within his majesty's breast. Xerxes, son of Darius, would not be judged by history inferior to his father, nor to his illustrious forebears, Cambyses and Cyrus the Great. These, who had vanquished and enslaved all Asia, would be joined in the pantheon of glory by Xerxes, their scion, who would now add Greece and Europe to the roll of provinces of the empire. Across all Hellas, Phobos advanced like a sapper's tunnel. One smelled the dust of its excavation in the still of morning and felt its yard-by-yard advance rumbling beneath one in his sleep. Of all the mighty cities of Greece, only Sparta, Athens, and Corinth held fast. These dispatched legation after legation to the wavering polis, seeking to bind them to the alliance. My own master was assigned in a single season to 5 separate overseas embassies. I puked over so many different ships' rails I couldn't recall one from the other. Everywhere these embassies touched, Phobos had called first. The fear made people reckless. Many were selling all they owned. Others, more heedless, were buying. "Let Xerxes spare his sword and send his purse instead," my master observed in disgust after yet another embassy had been rebuffed. "The Greeks will trample one another's bones, racing to see who first can sell his freedom." Always upon these legations, a part of my mind kept alert for word of my cousin. 3 times in my 17th year the service of my master brought me through the city of the Athenians. Each time I inquired after the location of the home of the gentlewoman whom Diomache and I had encountered that morning on the road to the 3 corners, when that fine lady had ordered Dio to seek her town estate and take service there. I secured at last the quarter and street, but never succeeded in finding the house. Once at a salon in the Athenian Academe, a lovely bride of 20 appeared, mistress of the household, and for a moment I was certain it was Diomache. My heart began to pound so violently that I must kneel upon one knee for fear of dropping to the floor dead faint. But the lady was not she. Nor was the bride glimpsed a year later bearing water from a spring in Naxos. Nor the physician's wife encountered under cloister in Histiaea 6 months thereafter. Upon one blistering summer evening 2 years before the battle at the gates, the ship bearing my master's legation touched briefly at Phaleron, a port of Athens. Our mission completed, we had 2 hours before tide's turn. I was granted leave, and on the run, at last located the house of the family of the Lady of the 3 Corners. The place was shuttered. Phobos had driven the clan forth to landholdings in Iapygia, or so I was informed by a loitering squad of Scythian archers, those thugs whom the Athenians employ as city constabulary. Yes, the brutes remembered Diomache. Who could forget her? They took me for another of her suitors and spoke in the crude language of the street. "The bird winged off," one said, "too wild for the cage." Another declared he had encountered her since in the market with a husband, a citizen and sea officer. "The fool bitch," he laughed, "to not with that salt sucker when she could have had me." Returning to Lacedaemon, I resolved to root this folly of longing from my heart as a farmer burns out a stubborn stump. I told Rooster it was time I took a bride. He found one for me, his cousin Thyrea, the daughter of his mother's sister. I was 18, she 15, when we were joined in the Messenian fashion practiced by the Helots. She bore a son within 10 months and a daughter while I was away on campaign. A husband now, I vow to think no more of my cousin. I would eradicate my own impiety and dwell no longer upon fancies. The years had passed swiftly. Alexandros completed his service as a youth of the Agoge. He was given his war shield and assumed his station among the peers of the army. He took to wife the maiden Agathe, just as he had promised. She bore him twins, a boy and girl, before he was 20. Polynices was crowned at Olympia for the second time, victor again in the sprint in armor. His wife, Althea, bore him a third son. The lady Arete produced for Dianeces no more children. She had come up barren after four daughters, without producing a male heir. Rooster's wife, Harmonia, bore a second child, a boy, whom he named Messenius. The lady Arete attended the birth, providing her own midwife and assisting at the delivery with her own hands. I myself bore the torch that escorted her home. She would not speak, so torn was she, between the joy of witnessing at last from her line the birth of a male, a defender for Lacedaemon, and the sorrow of knowing that this boy-child, issue of her brother's bastard, Rooster, with all his treasonous defiance of his Spartan masters, right down to the name he had chosen for his son, would face the sternest and most perilous passage to manhood. The Persian myriads stood now in Europe. They had bridged the Hellespont and traversed all of Thrace. Still the Hellenic allies wrangled. A force of 10,000 heavy infantry, commanded by the Spartan Ioannitas, was dispatched to Tempe in Thessaly, there to make a stand against the invader at the northernmost frontier of Greece. But the site, when the army got there, proved undefendable. The position could be turned by land via the pass at Gonus and outflanked by sea through Aulis. In disgrace and mortification, the force of 10,000 pulled out and dispersed to its constituent cities. A desperate paralysis possessed the Congress of the Greeks. Thessaly, abandoned, had gone over to the Persian, adding her matchless cavalry to swell the squadrons of the foe. Thebes teetered at the brink of submission. Argos was sitting it out. Dread omens and prodigies abounded. The oracle of Apollo at Delphi had counseled the Athenians, "Fly to the ends of the earth," while the Spartan council of elders, notoriously slow to action, yet dithered and dawdled. A stand must be made somewhere. But where? In the end it was their women who galvanized the Spartans into action. It came about like this. Refugees, many brides with babes, were flooding into the last of the free cities. Young mothers took flight to Lacedaemon, islanders and relations fleeing the Persian advance across the Aegean. These brides inflamed their listeners' hatred of the foe with tales of the conqueror's atrocities in their earlier passage through the islands. How the enemy at Chios and Lesbos and Tenedos had formed dragnets at one end of the territory and advanced across each island, scouring out every hiding place, hauling forth the young boys, herding the handsomest together, and castrating them for eunuchs, killing every man and raping the women, selling them forth into foreign slavery. The babies' heads, these heroes of Persia, dashed against the walls, splattering their brains upon the paving stones. The wives of Sparta listened with icy fury to these tales, cradling their own infants at their breasts. The Persian hordes had swept now through Thrace and Macedonia. The baby murderers stood upon the doorstep of Greece, and where was Sparta and her warrior defenders? Blundering homeward, unblooded from the fool's errand of Tempe. I had never seen the city in such a state as in the aftermath of that debacle. Heroes with prizes of valor skulked about, countenances downcast with shame, while their women snapped at them with scorn and held themselves aloof and disdainful. How could Tempe have happened? Any battle, even a defeat, would have been preferable to none at all. To marshal such a magnificent force, garland it before the gods, transport it all that way, and not draw blood, even one's own. This was not merely disgraceful, but, the wives declared, blasphemous. The women's scorn excoriated the city. A delegation of wives and mothers presented itself to the ephors, insisting that they themselves be sent out next time, armed with hairpins and distaffs, since surely the women of Sparta could disgrace themselves no more egregiously nor accomplish less than the vaunted 10,000. In the warriors' messes, the mood was even more corrosive. How much longer would the allied Congress dither? How many more weeks would the ephors delay? I recall vividly the morning when at last the proclamation came. The Heracles regiment trained that day in a dry water course called the Corridor, a blistering funnel between sandbanks north of the village of Limni. The men were running impact drills, two on ones and three on twos, when a distinguished elder named Charilaus, who had been an ephor and a priest of Apollo, but now functioned primarily as a senior counselor and emissary, appeared on the crest of the bank and spoke aside to the polemarch Dercylides, the regimental commander. The old man was past 70. He had lost the lower half of a leg in battle years past. For him to have hobbled on his staff this far from the city could only mean something big had happened. The patriarch and the polemarch spoke in private. The drills went on. No one looked up, yet every man knew. This was it. Dianeces' men got the word from Laterides, commander of the adjacent platoon, who passed it down the line. "It's the gates, lads." The hot gates. Thermopylae. No assembly was called. To the astonishment of all, the regiment was dismissed. The men were given the whole rest of the day off. Such a holiday had only been granted half a dozen times in my memory. Invariably, the peers broke up in high spirits and made for home at the trot. This time, no one budged. The entire regiment stood nailed to the site in the sweltering confines of the dry river, buzzing like a hive. Here was the word. For Morai, 5,000 men would be mobilized for Thermopylae. The column, reinforced by four perioecic regiments and packing squires and armed helots two to a man, would march out as soon as the Carnea, the festival of Apollo, which prohibited taking up arms, expired. 2.5 weeks. The force would total 20,000 men, twice the number at Tempe, concentrated in a pass 10 times narrower. Another 30,000 to 50,000 allied infantry would be mobilized behind this initial force, while a main force of the allied navy, 120 ships of war, would seal the straits at Artemisium and Andros and the narrows of the Euripus, protecting the army at the gates from flank assault by sea. This was a massive call-up. So massive it smelled. Dianeces knew it, and so did everyone else. My master humped back to the city, accompanied by Alexandros, now a full-line warrior of the platoon, his mates Bias, Black Leon, and their squires. A third of the way along, we overtook the elder Charilaus, shambling home with painful slowness, supported by his attendant Sthenisthes, who was as ancient as he. Black Leon led an ass of the train on a halter. He insisted the old man ride. Charilaus declined, but permitted the place to his servant. "Cut through the shit for us, will you, old uncle?" Dianeces addressed the statesman affectionately, but with a soldier's impatience for the truth. "I relay only what I'm instructed, Dianeces. The gates won't hold 50,000, they won't hold 5." A wry expression wizened the old-timer's face.
"I see you fancy your generalship superior to Leonidas's."
One fact was self-evident even to us squires. The Persian army stood now in Thessaly. That was what, 10 days to the gates? Less? In 2.5 weeks, their millions would sweep through and be 80 miles beyond. They'd be parked upon our threshold. "How many in the advance party?" Black Leon inquired of the elder. He meant the forward force of Spartans that would, as always in advance of a mobilization, be dispatched to Thermopylae now, at once, to take possession of the pass before the Persians got there and before the main force of the allied army moved up.
"You'll hear it from Leonidas tomorrow," the old man replied.
But he saw the younger men's frustration.
300, he volunteered. "All peers. All sires."
My master had a way of setting his jaw, a fierce clamping action of the teeth, which he employed when he was wounded on campaign and didn't want his men to know how bad. I looked. This expression stood now upon his face. An all-sire unit was comprised only of men who were fathers of living sons. This was so that, should the warriors perish, their family lines would not be extinguished. An all-sire was a suicide unit, a force dispatched to stand and die. My customary duties upon return from training were to clean and stow my master's gear and look to, with the servants of the mess, the preparation of the evening meal. Instead, this day Dionyces asked Black Leon for his squire to do double duty. Myself he ordered on ahead at a run to his own home. I was to inform the Lady Arete that the regiment had been dismissed for the day and that her husband would arrive at home shortly. I was to issue an invitation to her on his behalf, would she and their daughters accompany him this afternoon for a ramble in the hills. I raced ahead, delivered this message, and was dismissed to my own pursuits. Some impulse, however, made me linger. From the hill above my master's cottage, I could see his daughters burst from the gate and dash with eager enthusiasm to greet him upon the way. Arete had prepared a basket of fruit, cheese, and bread. The party was all barefoot, wearing big, floppy sun hats. I saw my master tug his wife aside beneath the oaks, and there speak privately with her for several moments. Whatever he said, it prompted her tears. She embraced him fiercely, both arms flung tight about his neck. Dionyces seemed at first to resist, then, in a moment, yielded and clamped his wife to him, holding her tenderly. The girls clamored, impatient to be off. Two puppies squalled underfoot. Dionyces and Arete released their embrace. I could see my master lift his youngest, Elandra, and plant her pony style astride his shoulders. He held the maiden Alexa's hand as they set off, the girls exuberant and gay, Dionyces and Arete lagging just a little. No main force army would be dispatched to Thermopylae. That tale was for public consumption only, to shore up the allies' confidence and put iron in their backbones. Only the 300 would be sent, with orders to stand and die. Dionyces would not be among them. He had no male issue. He could not be selected.
Chapter 16. I must now recount an incident of battle several years previous, whose consequences at this present juncture came powerfully to affect the lives of Dionyces, Alexandros, Arete, and others in this narrative. This occurred at Enophyta against the Thebans 1 year after Antirion. I refer to the extraordinary heroism demonstrated on that occasion by my mate Rooster. Like myself at the time, he was just 15, and had been serving green as grass for less than 12 months as first squire of Alexandros's father Olympius. The army's fronts had clashed. The Menelaian, Polias, and Wild Olive regiments were locked in a furious struggle with the Theban left, which was stacked 20 deep instead of the customary 8, and was holding its position with terrific stubbornness. To augment this peril, the foe's wing overlapped the Spartan right 1/8 mile. These elements now began to wheel inboard and advance, taking the Menelaian in the flank. Simultaneously, the enemy's right, which was taking the most grievous casualties, lost cohesion and fell back upon the massed ranks of its rear men. The foe's right broke in panic, while his left advanced. In the midst of this melee, Olympius received a crippling lizard-sticker wound through the arch of the foot from the butt-spike of an enemy spear. This came, as I said, at a moment of extreme dislocation upon the field, with the enemy right collapsing and the Spartans surging into the pursuit while the foe's left wheeled in attack, supported by numbers of their cavalry coursing uncontested across the broken field. Olympias found himself alone upon the open gleaning ground to the rear of the unrolling battle, with his foot wound rendering him crippled, while his cross-crested officer's helmet provided an irresistible target for any would-be hero of the enemy's ranging horse. 3 Theban cavalrymen went after him. Rooster, unarmed and unarmored, sprinted headlong into the fray, snatching a spear from the ground as he ran. Dashing up to Olympias, he not only employed his master's shield to protect him from the missile weapons of the enemy, but took on the attacking horsemen single-handedly, wounding and driving off 2 with spear thrusts and caving in the skull of the 3rd with the man's own helmet, which he, Rooster, in the madness of the moment, had torn off the fellow's head with his bare hands as he simultaneously ripped him out of his seat. Rooster even succeeded in capturing the handsomest of the 3 horses, a magnificent battle mount, which he used in the aftermath to draw the litter which evacuated Olympias safely from the field. When the army returned to Lacedaemon after this campaign, Rooster's exploit was the talk of the city. Among the peers, his prospects were debated at length. What should be done with this boy? All recalled that though his mother was a Messenian helot, his father had been the Spartiate Idetikides, Arete's brother, a hero slain in battle at Mantinea when Rooster was 2. The Spartans, as I have noted, have a grade of warrior youth, a stepbrother class called a Mothax. Bastards like Rooster, and even legitimate sons of peers who, through misfortune or poverty, have lost their citizenship, may be, if deemed worthy, plucked from their straits and elevated to this station. This honor was now proffered to Rooster. He turned it down. His stated reason was that he was already 15. It was too late for him. He preferred to remain in service as a squire. This rejection of their generous offer enraged the peers of Olympias's mess and created an outrage, as much as the affair of a helot bastard could within the city at large. Assertions were made to the point that this headstrong ingrate was notorious for his disloyal sentiments. He was a type not uncommon among slaves, prideful and stubborn. He sees himself as Messenian. He must either be eliminated and his family with him, or secured beyond doubt of betrayal to the Spartan cause. Rooster eluded assassination at the hands of the Cryptea that time, largely due to his youth and to Olympias's intercession, man to man among the peers. The affair faded for the moment, rekindling itself, however, upon subsequent campaigns when Rooster again and again proved himself the boldest and most valorous of the young squires, surpassing all in the army save Suicide, Cyclops, main man of the Olympic pentathlete Alpheus, and Polynices's squire Acanthus. The Persians stood at the threshold of Greece. Now the 300 were being selected for Thermopylae. Olympias would be prominent among them, with Rooster at his shoulder in his service. Could this treasonous youth be trusted, with a blade in his fist and himself a handbreadth from the polemarch's back? The last thing Sparta needed at this desperate hour was trouble at home with the helots. The city could not stand a revolt, even an abortive one. Rooster, by this time aged 20, had become a force among the Messenian laborers, farmers, and vineyardmen. He was a hero to them, a youth whose courage in battle could have been exploited by him as a ticket out of his servitude. He could be wearing Spartan scarlet and lording it over his mean-birthed brothers, but this he had disdained. He had declared himself Messenian, and his fellows never forgot. Who knows how many of them followed Rooster in their hearts? How many absolutely vital craftsmen and support personnel, armorers and litter-bearers, squires and vittlerymen. It is an ill wind, they say, that blows no one good, and this Persian invasion could be the best thing that ever happened to the helots. It could spell deliverance, freedom. Would they stand loyal? Like the gate of a mighty citadel which turns upon a single tempered hinge, much of the Messenian sentiment focused its attention upon Rooster, and stood ready to take its cue from him. It was now the night before the proclamation of the 300. Rooster was summoned to stand 2 before Olympias's mess, the Bellerophon. There, officially and with the goodwill of all, the honor of Spartan scarlet was again offered to the youth. Again he spurned it. I loitered deliberately in that hour outside the Bellerophon to see which way the issue would go. It took no imagination, hearing the murmur of outrage within and beholding Rooster's swift and silent exit, to read the gravity of the issue and its peril. An assignment for my master detained me for the bulk of an hour. At last I found opportunity to scamper free. Beside the little ring where the starter's box stands is a grove with a dry course branching in three directions. There Rooster and I and other boys used to meet and even bring girls, because if you were found you could dash away easily in the dark down one of the three dry riverbeds. I knew he would be there now, and he was. To my amazement, Alexandras was with him. They were arguing. It took only moments to see it was the clash of one who wishes to be another's friend and the other who rejects him. What was startling was that it was Alexandras who wanted to be friend to Rooster. He would be in calamitous trouble if he was caught, so immediately subsequent to his initiation as a warrior. As I skittered down into the shadows of the dry course, Alexandras was cursing Rooster and declaring him a fool. "They'll kill you now, don't you know that? Fuck them. Fuck them all." "Stop this," I burst down between them. I recited what all three of us knew, that Rooster's prestige among the lower orders precluded him from acting for himself alone. What he did bore repercussions for his wife, his son and daughter, his family. He had cooked himself and them with him. The Cryptea would finish him this very night, and nothing would suit Polynices more. "He won't catch me if I'm not here." Rooster had set his mind to flee, this night, to the Temple of Poseidon at Taenarun, where a helot could be granted sanctuary. He wanted me to come. I told him he was insane. "What were you thinking when you turned them down? What they offered you is an honor. Fuck their honors. The Cryptea hunts me now, in darkness, faceless, as cowards. Is that honor?" I told him his slave's pride had bought his own ticket to hell. "Shut up, both of you." Alexandras ordered Rooster to his shell, that term the Spartans used to describe the mean huts of the helots. "If you're going to run, run now." We sprinted away down the dark watercourse. Harmonia had both children, Rooster's daughter and infant son, packed and ready, in the smoky confines of the helot's shell. Alexandras pressed into Rooster's hand a clutch of Igenitan obols, not much but all he had, enough to aid a runaway. This gesture struck Rooster speechless. "I know you don't respect me," Alexandras told him. "You think yourself my better in skill at arms, in strength, and in valor. Well, you are. I have tried, as the gods are my witness, with every fiber of my being, and still I'm not half the fighter you are. I never will be. You should stand in my place, and I in yours. It is the gods' injustice that makes you a slave and me free." This, from Alexandras, utterly disarmed Rooster. You could see the combativeness in his eyes relent, and his proud defiance slacken and abate. "You own more of valor than I ever will," the bastard replied, "for you manufacture it out of a tender heart, while the gods sat me up punching and kicking from the cradle. And you do yourself honor to speak with such candor. You're right, I did despise you. Until this moment." Rooster glanced at me then. I could see confusion in his aspect. He was moved by Alexandras's integrity, which pulled his heart strongly to remain and even to yield. Then, with an effort, he broke the spell. "But you won't influence me, Alexandras. Let the Persian come. Let him grind all Lacedaemon into dust. I'll jig on its grave." We heard Harmonia gasp. Outside, torches flared. Shadows surrounded the shell. Its blanket flap was torn open. There, in the rude doorway, stood Polynices, armed and backed by four assassins of the Cryptea. They were all young, athletes nearly on a par with the Olympian, and pitiless as iron. They burst in and bound Rooster with cord. The infant boy wailed in Harmonia's arms. The poor girl was barely 17. She shuddered and wept, pulling her daughter in terror to her side. Polynices absorbed the sight with contempt. His glance flicked over Rooster, his wife and babes and myself, to settle with scorn upon the person of Alexandros. "I might have known we'd find you here." "And I you," the youth responded. On his face was written plain his hatred of the Crypteia. Polyneikes regarded Alexandros and his sentiments with barely contained outrage. "Your presence here in these precincts constitutes treason. You know it, and so do these others. Out of respect to your father only, I will say this once. Leave now. Depart at once, and nothing more will be said. The dawn will find four helots missing."
"I will not," Alexandros answered.
Rooster spat. "Kill us all, then," he demanded of Polyneikes. "Show us Spartan valor, you night-skulking cowards." A fist smashed his teeth, silencing him. I saw hands seize Alexandros and felt others clamp me. Thongs of hide bound my wrists. A gag of linen stoppered my throat. The Cryptes snatched Harmonia and her babes. "Bring them all," Polyneikes ordered.
Chapter 17.
There stands a grove upslope behind the Deucalion mess, where the men and hounds customarily muster before setting off on a hunt. There, within minutes, a rump court stood assembled. The sight is a grisly one. Rude kennels extend beneath the oaks, with their game nets and chase harnesses hanging beneath the eaves of the feeding stations. The mess kitchen stores its slaughtering implements in several double-locked outbuildings. Upon the inner doors hang hatchets and gutting knives, cleavers and bone breakers. A blood-black chopping board for game, fowl, and poultry extends along the wall, where the birds' heads are whacked off and toppled to the dirt for the hounds to scrap over. Piles of plucked feathers collect as high as a man's calf, rendered sodden by the blood drippings of the next luckless fowl to stretch its gullet beneath the chopper. Above these, along the runway, stand the bars of the butchery with their heavy iron hooks for the hanging, gutting, and bleeding of game. It was a foregone conclusion that Rooster must die, and his infant son with him. What remained yet at issue was the fate of Alexandros, and his treason, which, if published throughout the city, would work grievous harm at this most peril-fraught hour, not only to himself and his station as a newly initiated warrior, but to the prestige of his entire clan, his wife, Agathe, his mother, Paralia, his father, the polemarch Olympius, and, not least of all, his mentor, Dianeces. This latter pair now took their place in the shadows, along with the other 16 peers of the Deucalion mess. Rooster's wife wept silently, her daughter beside her. The baby squalled, muffled, in her arms. Rooster knelt in his cord bonds, on his knees in the dry, high summer dust. Polyneikes paced impatiently, wanting a decision.
"May I speak?"
Rooster croaked in a throat hoarse from having been throttled on the way to this summary arraignment. "What has scum like you to say?" Polyneikes demanded. Rooster indicated Alexandros.
"This man your thugs think they captured. They should be declaring him a hero. He took me captive, he and Xeonese. That's why they were in my shell, to arrest me and bring me in."
"Of course," Polyneikes replied sarcastically. "That's why they had you bound so tightly." Olympius addressed Alexandros.
"Is this true, son? Did you indeed place the youth Rooster in custody?"
"No, father, I did not."
All knew that this trial would not last long. Discovery was inevitable even here in the shadows by the Agoge youths, who stood sentry over the night city, their patrols doubled now for wartime. The assembly had perhaps 5 minutes, no more. In two brief exchanges, as if the peers couldn't divine it themselves, it became clear that Alexandros had at the 11th hour attempted to persuade Rooster into rescinding his defiance and accepting the city's honor, that he had failed, and that still he had taken no action against him. This was treason, pure and simple, Polyneikes declared. Yet, he said, he personally had no wish to defame and punish the son of Olympius, nor even myself, the squire of Dianeces.
Let it end here. You gentlemen retire. Leave this helot and his brat to me. Deianakes now spoke. He expressed his gratitude to Polyneikes for this offer of clemency. There remained, however, an aspect of half-exoneration to the knight's suggestion. Let us not leave it at that, but clear Alexandros's name entire. May he, Deianakes requested, speak on the young man's behalf. The senior maiden assented, the peers seconding him. Deianakes spoke. You gentlemen all know my feelings for Alexandros. All of you are aware that I have counseled and mentored him since he was a child. He is like a son to me, and a friend and brother as well. But I will not defend him out of these sentiments. Rather, my friends, consider these points. What Alexandros was attempting this night is nothing other than that which his father has been trying since Inophyta, that is, to influence informally by reason and persuasion and out of friendly feeling this boy Decton called Rooster, to soften the bitterness he bears against us Spartans, who he feels have enslaved his countrymen, and to bring him around to the greater cause of Lacedaemon. In this endeavor, Alexandros has not this night and never has sought any advantage for himself. What good could come to him from enlisting this renegade beneath Spartan scarlet? His thought was alone for the good of the city, to harness to its use a young man of clearly demonstrated vigor and courage, the bastard son of a peer and hero, my own wife's brother, Eidetikides. In fact, you may hold me to blame along with Alexandros, for I more than once have referred to this boy Rooster as my by-blow nephew. Yes, Polyneikes put in swiftly, as a joke and term of derision. We do not joke here tonight, Polyneikes. There was a rustle among the leaves, and suddenly, to the astonishment of all, there into the slaughtering space advanced the Lady Arete. I glimpsed a pair of barn urchins escaping into shadow. Clearly these spies had witnessed the scene at Rooster's shell and dashed at once to relay it to the lady. Now she came forward. Wearing a plain peplos robe, with her hair down, summoned no doubt from bedtime lullabies just moments previous. The peers parted before her, taken so by surprise that none could momentarily find voice to protest. "What is this?" she demanded with scorn. "A skull court beneath the oaks? What august verdict will you brave warriors pronounce tonight? To murder a maiden, or slit the throat of an infant?" Deianakes sought to silence her, and the others did as well, with declamations to the effect that a woman had no business here. She must depart at once. They would hear of nothing else. Arete, however, ignored these utterly, stepping without hesitation to the side of the girl Harmonia, and there seizing Rooster's infant and taking him into her arms. "You say my presence here can serve no purpose. On the contrary," she declared to the peers, "I can offer most apposite assistance. See, I can tilt this child's jaw back to make his assassination easier. Which of you sons of Heracles will slice this infant's throat? You, Polyneikes? You, my husband?" More declarations of outrage ensued, insisting that the lady vacate at once. Deianakes himself voiced this in the most emphatic terms. Arete would not budge. "If this young man's life were all that were at stake," her gesture indicated Rooster, "I would obey my husband and you other peers without hesitation. But who else will you heroes be compelled to murder in addition? The boy's half-brothers? His uncles and cousins and their wives and children, all of them innocent and all assets which the city needs desperately in this hour of peril?" It was reasserted that these issues were none of the lady's concern. Actaeon, the boxer, addressed her directly. "With respect, lady, none can but see that your intention is to shield from extinction your honored brother's line." And he gestured to the squalling boy-child. "Even in this, its bastard form." "My brother has already achieved imperishable fame," the lady responded with heat, "which is more than can be said for any of you. No, it is simple justice I seek. This child you stand ready to murder is not the issue of this boy, Rooster."
This statement appeared so irrelevant as to border upon the preposterous.
"Then whose is he?"
Actaeon demanded impatiently. The lady hesitated not a moment. "My husband's," she replied. Snorts of incredulity greeted this.
"Truth is an immortal goddess, lady," the senior maiden spoke sternly. "One would be wise to consider before defaming her."
"If you don't believe me, ask this girl, the child's mother."
The peers plainly granted no credence whatever to